Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, August 14th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from the New York Military Academy, Cornwall, a co-ed college preparatory boarding school focusing on academics, character, and athletics. Now accepting applications for fall 2017, nyma.org. Joining this afternoon is Dr. Paul Singh of Albany Medical Center. He specializes in gastric bypass and hernia repair surgeries. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. That's 1-800-348-2551. That's Dr. Singh. Your calls and much more, all coming up on Vox Pop right after this news. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. In the studio this afternoon is Dr. Paul Singh of Albany Medical Center. He specializes in minimally invasive procedures. He is widely recognized for applying his robotic surgical expertise to gastroenterology and other general surgery, including robotic gastric bypass surgery. He also performs advanced minimally invasive hernia repair. He earned his medical degree from the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Singh, welcome back. We always love to have you.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks for inviting me back, and I look forward to a great afternoon.
Yep. To participate in today's discussion, call 1-800-348-2551. Again, that's 1-800-348-2551. You can also check in with your questions and comments on Facebook at facebook.com/WMC Radio. Tweet us at WMC Vox Pop or email. That's the way I would do it if I were you. Email voxpop@wmc.org. So, Doc, tell me about something. I see that all your stuff is now robotic. Well, much of your stuff is now robotic. Has that changed outcomes in terms of hernia surgery or any of the other stuff?
Well, I think this is a sort of a topic that's coming across the entire world about where robots fit into what we're doing and how our life will be. You know, minimally invasive surgery has been around for 20 plus years. And now in the last 5 years, we've seen sort of advancements in how that can be done by using a robot to facilitate patient recovery, less pain, less discomfort. So like anything else, they're becoming part of the framework of what the future will be with our care and with using robots.
So for a while, there was some trouble with mesh. People were getting sued and all the rest of it. Has the mesh which goes into the hernia repair been changed?
Now, the mesh, if you look across the world, there's about 110 different meshes you can use.
You got to make a lot of meshes that way.
Yeah, I think so. But each company has its own specific need or own specific goal they're trying to fit. And it's like putting a square peg in a round hole. If you try to force it, you'll lead to problems. But if you use the right mesh in the right place, at the right location, it improves patient outcomes, improves where they go. So a lot of these mesh problems we see are really not problems. They're just issues that occurred with using materials that weren't designed for exactly what they were used for.
Gotcha. Now let's switch over for a moment while we're waiting for some phone calls to weight loss, to bariatric surgery. I had a little bit of a discussion with my friend Paul Lemansky the other day, and I noted that after bariatric surgery, it was my impression that I had read that people were waking up and they did not have diabetic problems anymore. What's that about?
So, Alan, you are pretty perceptive in your reading here, is that diabetes can be improved with weight loss surgery. And specific weight loss surgeries actually improve it even better. So we know that Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, which is the division of the stomach and bypassing the intestines, sort of a bigger operation, results in both more weight loss, but also results in improvement in some of our endocrinologic problems. So diabetes goes away, and people don't exactly know it yet. So if you figure it out, you got your Nobel Prize to put on your shelf.
In other words, it goes away, but we don't know why it goes away.
Well, we have a couple ideas as to why it goes away. We think because of how food gets into our intestinal tract, it stimulates different hormones and changes how our pancreas functions and what occurs. And if you look at now on a molecular level, and this is what some of our drug companies and our friends are doing in research labs, are they're showing that the genetics of our body actually change because of how food reaches those areas, and we're expressing different genes or epigenetics that are changing because of that procedure.
So, go ahead.
So it's still unknown, but it is a demonstrated effect that we see quite regularly. Patients coming in on very little oral diabetic medications or very little insulin, leave the hospital not taking anything at all.
Amazing.
And therefore, they're cured or improved to such a state that they don't have to worry about diabetes anymore.
Now, my understanding of all of this is that there are two, the stomach stapling and stomach banding. I understand that the stomach banding is done less now. Is that a misinformation?
Yeah, what used to be called the LAP band or the adjustable gastric band, still around and still FDA approved, but less frequently used because of what we know about it. Now that it's about 15 plus years out, we know that it works in a smaller subset of patients, and they really have to have good diet, exercise, and lifestyle control to get the outcome that they're looking for. And if they don't have that outcome, if they don't do that well, then the band can go in, but they may not lose weight, nor may they have the desired weight loss that they wanted to have from
that. What about the stapling, though? Can't you – I mean, I know people who just can't lose the weight, even on the stapling.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, like we tell people a lot of times, it's not an operation that fixes you. It's sort of a multifactorial process. So we talk about the changes in diet, exercise, lifestyle, though they're all mandated that have to happen with anything. So you and I can lose weight, and everyone can lose weight by just adjusting our diet, our exercise, and our lifestyle. Now, some people need the additions of medications and surgery to get them to the point where they improve their health problems. But we always have to have diet, exercise, and lifestyle as part of our armamentarium to help us with weight.
Okay, we'll go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim in Matamoros, you're on. Go.
Well, I'll change the question. If these were talking about the mesh there, is the vest over pants method of hernia repair ever used anymore?
Well, some surgeons still use the Mayo vest over pants repair. It was written by the Mayo brothers, who are surgeons in Minnesota. It goes back 100 plus years. It was originally used to when mesh wasn't as available on making a way to fix hernias, especially around the belly button. So people still use it, and the outcomes are just like they've been for the last 100 plus years. There's about a 15 to 20% chance you'll get a recurrence back, as opposed to sometimes using a piece of mesh now where the rates are now down to about 2 to 3% if they recur.
Paul, could you explain to the audience because I wasn't following that question.
Very technical question about how the surgical repair is done, and the incision that's made to put the two layers of your abdominal wall back together is sort of like the old-fashioned wearing a vest over pants. So instead of bringing the edges of the tissues back together to touch and then to reapproximate them, you actually slide one over top of the other like you would put a vest over your pants.
Oh, I get it.
To cover it. And that was sort of how it got described in the literature and how it was known by that mnemonic for years.
Okay, great. Oh, thank you, Jim. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are excellent. At the end of the show, you won't get near this place. Let's go to Charmaine in Glens Falls. Okay, Charmaine, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am curious about the difference between the gastric sleeve and an RNY, and is there one that is better in terms of an ability to take in nutrients?
So the gastric bleed, is that what you
mean? Gastric sleeve.
Sleeve, okay.
Yes. So basically the gastric sleeve is an operation where the stomach is divided into a shape of the size of a banana. So basically 60 to 70% of the stomach is taken out and removed, leaving your stomach that looks sort of like a banana in shape, so that you each eat much less. Now, even though you have that stomach taken out and you have less hunger that occurs because of the portion that's removed, you still have normal absorption in that operation. So as things pass through the first portion of your intestine called your duodenum, you still will absorb content and nutrients within it. So it's very less likely to develop nutritional deficiencies. But that trade-off is it's a little less likely to lose as much weight with that operation.
Is there any statistic on cancer after these, stomach cancer, for example?
So we do a very good job of screening patients before and part of their history when we talk to them, and also analyzing them with endoscopies and other preoperative testing to sort of eliminate those patients who potentially are at risk for gastric cancer. But the literature tells us that it's very rare to find someone who's had either of these procedures to develop a gastric cancer. Not zero, but very rare that you
would
see that.
Have you ever gone in and found it?
There's been case reports of it. I personally haven't seen that. I think it's because adequate screening we do before, and in patients who are at risk, we advise them to do other operations or other things so that that wouldn't be an issue long term.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. And now we're going to go to, let's see here, John in Troy on line number 3. John in Troy, you're on. Hey, John.
Hello.
Hello, John.
No, this is Patrick.
Okay, Patrick, go ahead.
Okay. Well, you were speaking of miracle cures, it sounded like, a few minutes ago. And I'll tell you a quick story. I had a hernia in my groin for decades, probably 30 years, and didn't bother me much, but I knew one of these days I was going to have it dealt with. And at some point, I needed some dental surgery, and I had to take a course of antibiotics. And in the meantime, this hernia would kind of come and go. You know, if I get up in the morning, it would be in, but during the course of the day, it would work its way out. But after doing this course of antibiotics, I realized it was staying in, it hasn't been out since, and that was at least 2 years ago, probably 2.5 years ago. Does that make sense?
So the question is, does it make sense?
Does it make sense?
Well, it would be unlikely if you had a palpable hernia, something you could feel yourself as you changed. A course of antibiotics would repair it. What our body has is natural defense mechanisms. So we have areas in our body, abdominal fat that fills a hole. And a lot of times what will happen is that abdominal fat will then fall in place and fill that hole sort of as a space filler, so you'll have less of the potential problems.
Sure.
But you still may have a hernia, but it now may be plugged by something from inside your abdominal wall. It would be very unlikely that a course of antibiotics would have repaired it. So I advise you probably want to check with your primary care doctor, go in and get looked at, because it can have significant problems if that hernia were to get stuck out or get what's called incarcerated in there.
You get some kind of strangulation.
You get strangulation, which leads to potential organ injury and more problems from that standpoint.
Sure. Well,
thanks, John.
I'd have some real discomfort if that were the case, right?
No, not necessarily. So
no.
Only when it becomes acutely stuck or what's called incarcerated, then you develop significant problems. But that may lead to emergency surgery, hospitalization, and even what a significant problem called sepsis.
And that's
when
you get called in the middle of the night?
What's that? Yeah, that's what leads to people being called in emergency surgery. And the outcomes from that are much, much not as well as having elective surgery where you have more options.
Thank you. I'm sorry, John. We got to take a break. Thanks for your call.
Okay,
appreciate
I got to get it checked.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Absolutely. Get it checked. All right. We got lots of phones here, and we'll be right back after a short, short, short break.
Support comes from New York Oncology Hematology, providing second opinions, immunotherapy, and clinical research trials for cancer patients. 30 physicians, 7 locations, newyorkoncology.com. Gear Village, a senior community where one can age in a supportive environment at all stages of life. GearVillage.org for information. Saratoga Hospital introducing the Addiction Medicine Program at the Saratoga Community Health Center, a dedicated team of medical, behavioral health, and social work professionals. Empire Exhibits and Displays, Mechanicville, New York, supplying the greater capital region with custom display solutions, commercial casework, and interactive exhibits for trade shows, special events, and museum exhibitions. EmpireExhibits.com. And from the 1850 House Inn and Tavern, Rosendale, New York, waterfront dining on their pet-friendly deck in the Hudson Valley, the 1850House.com.
And we are back, and we are delighted. We are absolutely delighted today to be talking about all kinds of things. And Dr. Paul Singh of Albany is with us, and he knows a lot. He's done a lot of these operations. We've got a Christine in Northampton. Okay, Christine, you're on.
Hi. I had the lap in several years ago, and I'm wondering, can you do the sleeve with a laser today?
After having a lap band surgery, was that what you were asking?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, usually.
Can I get the question again, Paul? I didn't quite understand.
So I think we're asking is if you have a lap band, can you have another operation like the sleeve done laparoscopically afterwards? And the answer to that question is yes, you can. Obviously, having the band in place requires a second an operation to remove the band and then be able to do an operation on the stomach. So there's sometimes a multi-step process to, one, remove the band, and then secondarily to go and have a sleeve. Some surgeons believe you can do it all at once. There are some trade-offs and there are some things. So if you're thinking about it, make sure you discuss it with the surgeon that you're talking to about what their outcomes are and how that's been.
Okay, they were also talking, though, about doing it with laser.
Yeah, usually when people talk about laser, it's talked about doing it laparoscopically or minimally invasively. So okay. Some people do use lasers, but I think the term is sort of goes back to the 90s when people did laparoscopy first with a laser, and so people started to get confused with that term. So I would just check with your surgeon, but most likely most of these are done laparoscopically or minimally invasively.
Christine, thanks for the good call. Appreciate it. All right, now we're off to John in Troy. All right, John in Troy, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. I was scheduled for the sleeve procedure a year ago, June. I was anesthetized and then finally awakened and was told they didn't proceed with the surgery because they didn't like the look of my liver. My question is there another way of doing the sleeve that doesn't involve moving the liver?
In general, most people who do have weight problems also have problems with what's called fatty liver or fatty involvement in their liver. And so
that's what I had.
Yep. And it's not uncommon for that liver to become enlarged to 2 to 3 times its normal size because of that fatty involvement. So there are ways to sort of mitigate that, to make that less of a risk for someone, and also to reduce the size of your liver before you go into that. So there are sort of special dietary changes and special treatment plans that you can do that can sometimes minimize it. And sometimes that can still allow the operation to be done minimally invasively, but sometimes it may require a conversion to an open operation. But in general, there are multiple different steps that can be done to help you have the operation, to help you lose your weight, because if you do have fatty liver, that can be a potentially life-threatening long-term complication that has other metabolic problems. So in that risk-benefit discussion, it's sometimes better to think about how I could get to that operation because it'll help me long-term, and the steps that can be done to get you there.
Now, what if there is, I was told that there was also early stages of non-alcoholic cirrhosis.
Yep.
Does that complicate it even more, or is that typical?
Yep, that is one of the major things that we're seeing now, what's called NASH, or non-alcoholic steatohepatitis is the term for it.
Yeah.
And it goes hand in hand sort of as a spectrum. The thought is that as people have fatty liver, especially for many years, it actually causes fibrosis and changes within the liver itself that become more permanent.
Uh-huh.
So that's why treating your fatty liver early leads to less potential problems with this NASH or steatohepatitis long term. So that's why you would want to try to get that weight off and get the fatty liver to be resolved. So
now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So if you do have NASH, there are ways to sort of work around that and to have the operation, but you should talk to your gastroenterologist and you should talk to your surgeon in much more detail about what the special steps may need to be done to have your operation.
Thank you, John. Okay, so 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Chances of getting in now are really excellent. Before we go to Jim, let me ask you a very fast question. I've known people who've had the bariatric surgery, and in some cases they were told, particularly early in the game, that they really had to lose weight before the doctor would proceed. Is that still de rigueur, or has that changed?
So I think there's multiple reasons why we want patients to lose weight before their operation. One is to show their commitment and also to learn the other aspects of diet, exercise, and lifestyle that they need to do to maintain their weight loss. Second is from a safety factor. As our last caller talked about, sometimes operations have to be stopped because the liver is so large, they have a fatty liver, they have complications that make the operation unsafe to do. So when we talk about risk reduction strategies, and that's really what we're talking about, is how do we reduce your risk to have an operation to improve your health long term? And those are the things we try to outline with people about what you can do to make that situation better. I use the analogy a lot of times. It's like walking across the road. You walk across the road when it's deserted, there's no cars, there's no traffic, and nothing's going to happen. You don't really step up to run across or walk across a highway. You want to make it so that you have a good outcome for your operation to get the long-term health that you're shooting for.
So thank you for that. Appreciate that very much. Let's go to Jim in North Pownell. Okay, Jim, you're on.
Good afternoon, doctors. I have a umbilical hernia, and my PCP at the Veterans Administration recommended that if it pops out, I just push it back in. And if it gets to the point where I can't push it back in, then I'm going to have to have something done with it. But I would just like a second opinion on it, if I may.
So the second opinion across the radio would tell you that from this distance, and depending on how large it is and what your other health problems are, we really decide about whether you should wait and watch and see what happens or whether you should have it repaired. And so depending on who you talk to or how the technique they will use, there are some risks associated with the operation and recovery. And if those risks are less than it would be to walk around and potentially get an incarcerated hernia, then you should probably think about having your hernia repaired. So yep. It also brings peace of mind because obviously you don't want to walk around all day with your hernia worrying whether it's going to get stuck or not being able to live your life.
No, I can always lay down on my back and pop it back in again if it does.
Yep.
So, Paul, let me get this straight. What exactly is a belly button hernia?
So a belly button hernia is where the area of our tissue when we were a baby, where our umbilical cord existed, should heal over and completely fuse together. So the strong layer of tissue called our fascia would form a barrier to allow things not to protrude from the inside. What happens over time, though, is that area gets weakened, things expand, and then contents inside our abdomen, like our intestines, our colon, blood vessels, and other things, can herniate through that opening and then stick out.
So when you get to be 69 years old,
things
start falling apart.
but I don't get it. This content will, because the thing is weak, gets through. Is that what happens?
So what happens is because there is no strong layer of tissue to hold things in place, it'll protrude underneath our skin. And sort of like then a mushroom, it'll sort of mushroom underneath our skin and eventually get caught. And that's what leads to the incarcerated or strangled hernia.
So a lot of people talk about, I've heard this debate between I have an innie or an outie.
Yeah.
Is one more of a predictor of a hernia?
Yeah, so if you have an outie, there's probably a high 99% chance you have a hernia.
I had an innie for 68 years, and then it turned into an outie.
So now you have the hernia that goes with that. So it is something, again, that you sort of look at that as how you would want to fix or repair is the sort of improving your quality of life. And that's a discussion you and your primary could have.
Thanks, Jim. Okay, now we'll go to Carl in Clifton Park. Okay, Carl, you're on.
Hello.
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 This is a second opinion question also, I guess. I recently discovered an inguinal hernia. That's what the doctor told me it is. I went to the surgeon, to a surgeon locally, and there's no pain. And again, I can push it in if it starts to protrude very much. He said he could either fix it or I could just live with it, and I could go back to normal activity. Whatever lifting I do and any other activity was okay. So I'm just wondering, is it advisable to get it repaired? Can it get worse, I guess, is the biggest concern. And it just occurred to me also, what about the mesh? I've heard some things that mesh is... takes longer to recover if they use mesh to repair the hernia, and there also can be problems with mesh. So those are my questions.
So those are pretty common questions for people who have hernias, and the answer has been fairly consistent for most surgeons that would tell you if you don't have a lot of symptoms, you don't have a lot of difficulty, you don't necessarily have to have it repaired immediately. But if you think of it in sort of a timeline, is if you have a hernia now, you'll have a hernia going forward. And if it becomes bigger and becomes a problem in the next 5 years, it'll be a bigger type of repair and bigger that needs to be and more that potentially needs to be done. So people fall on the spectrum of being proactive or reactive, as it were, for this. So that's where it goes to discussing with your surgeon or with someone who's when you've been referred to that about how they'll fix it and what will happen. So a lot of times the repair rates, we talk about complications from hernia surgery now being in the single digits, usually in the 1% or 2%. Now, that includes potential problems with mesh and potential problems with other issues. So if those rates sort of seem to be something that you would want to consider, then getting it repaired would then alleviate these problems into the next 5, 10, 15 years of your life. So this is something where it's sort of been more proactive than reactive. Years ago, we would say, well, if it doesn't bother you, don't worry about it until it does bother you, and then you take care of it. Now it's, do I want to improve my quality of life? Will it help me to exercise? Will I have less discomfort? Can I be more active with it because I get it done now? And that's what you want to think about with it. And the use of mesh and materials help in how it heals long-term and what happens with it. But these days, hernia surgery is much different than it was 15 years ago. 15, 20 years ago, we talk about 6 to 8 weeks of prolonged recovery. Now we talk about returning to work in the order of 5-7 days, full activities within the order of about 2 to 3 weeks after doing some of the minimally invasive hernia repairs. So it's a much different world.
But I see what Carl is talking about. You know, I get up in the middle of the night every once in a while and watch bad television. You know, I watch Gunsmoke or whatever. And they always have somebody, a lawyer coming on and saying, so-and-so mesh was bad mesh, you know, like that. And if you had, mesh surgery with mesh, you should come to us and we'll help you sue the doctor. Now, I know that this is not exactly an attractive proposition for physicians who probably don't get up in the middle of the night, but is there any accuracy to that?
Obviously, there is accuracy with things not occurring the way they should, as you would want, and potential problems that do occur. But I think this is a great opportunity to talk about the reality of what life is as opposed to sort of the extremes of what may happen. And so it is one of these aspects where we talk about what the real life chances of hernia repair may be and what the outcomes will be and what the quality of life would be. And that's always worth a discussion in talking to someone if you do have that problem, rather than waiting to have a problem or watch on TV and say, I won't do something because I see the far end of the spectrum of only problems that occur.
Gotcha. Thank you, Carl. Okay. And we're going to go now to Lenore in Turner's Falls, Massachusetts. If you guys want to get on, this is a good time to do it. 1-800-348-2551. Lenore, you're on. Go ahead, Lenore.
Hi. I am 69 years old, and last year I had my first episode of diverticulitis. Now this is about the second time this year. I wonder if there's any way to prevent it, and it's horribly painful, and how many doctors are over 65 that practice that have had diverticulitis. It seems like every person I talk to, they're suffering with it too, and I believe it's seasonal. And how do I avoid, I know I'm asking a lot of questions, how do I avoid this when I love fruit and vegetables?
Well, you asked a lot of good questions, and you asked some of the probing questions about the disease. And unfortunately, as we do get older, we do have more of these outpouching, and diverticulitis is an outpouching of your colon, where weaknesses in the wall lead to sort of outpouchings that can potentially retain food, and especially seeds, nuts, other things can get lodged in there, and that's what leads to these attacks.
When you say outpouching, that means?
Sort of what the Latin, the diverticulum, so an area that comes off the main passageway.
But there is, again, I'm sorry to use this again, is it an in-ear or an outie?
Well, it's an
If the seed gets into the pouch, it's got to leave a little cavity there, right?
Well, the pouch stays full but becomes blocked of getting the contents back into the main channel of the colon, and that leads to then the blockage within the diverticulum, which then causes the inflammation and then causes the problem.
So what's the difference between diverticulitis and diverticulosis?
Well, diverticulosis is the benign form of having those outpouchings. When you start to get complications like inflammation, infection, fevers, that's when it becomes diverticulitis.
Gotcha.
And so diverticulitis and having multiple attacks of it can be very painful and can be very cause scarring in the colon and to do that. And if you've had those, you should probably talk to your gastroenterologist or talk to a colorectal surgeon about which is the best options for it. And the majority of options are, right now, if it's not surgical, is to do things about lifestyle management. Watch the food you eat, make sure you stay hydrated, make sure you avoid constipation, and all the steps that would help you to maintain your colonic health. But again, this is something you should talk to your gastroenterologist, and especially if you've had more than one attack, talk to them about whether it is worth doing something more aggressively like surgery, or whether just management with lifestyles fits appropriately.
And what would the surgery be?
Well, they actually take the area where you're having these block, where you have this diverticulitis, and actually resect it. And when it's an elective type operation, they can make it so they clean the colon and get the ends to come back together, and then have a much favorable outcome, thereby not requiring an ostomy or other potential issues that occur with that.
Yeah. Okay, Lenore?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, it's 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. When we come back from our short little breaklet, we're going to talk to Alice and any of you who want to dial that number, 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Nathan LaTower Hospital, offering baby boxes to babies born in the Nathan LaTower Birthing Center, helping to provide a safe sleep environment for newborns, NLH.org. Blue Sky Bicycles, Saratoga Springs, New York, now offering electric bikes to the Capital Region, featuring pedal assist bikes with test rides available, blueskybicycles.com. Seniors Helping Seniors, offering help for seniors by seniors, assisting them to live independently at home, 413-822-9988. And from HMT at the Spa Little Theater, beginning their 33rd season with Peter and the Star Catcher, weekends October 14th through 29th at the Spa Little Theater, Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org. And from Noble Home, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, offering design-build services that feature passive, solar, and energy-efficient designs, supporting the local economy using local materials. Prefabricated house kits also available, noble-home.net.
We are back with Dr. Paul Singh. Okay, what's going on 99 Delaware Avenue?
Oh, Alan, that's going to be our new bariatric office. It's going to be for bariatric and clinical nutrition. So we have a multidisciplinary center there for patients who want to lose weight, not just by surgery alone, but also medical management. And now we fortunately have been able to build I think the term in the cooking world is a test kitchen, but we're actually building a nutritional kitchen so that we can hold classes for patients who want to learn how to cook healthy, learn about nutrition from the basics of how to build recipes and how to do things from that aspect. And one of the faculty that are involved in this have been involved in getting the medical students and also dietitians and other interns and people involved in what the new delivery of healthcare for nutrition should mean.
Huh. You know, I've just invented a new diet. I wonder what your theory on it is, and that is it's called the cucumber diet. I'm going to start tonight on my new diet, which is only eating for the final meal of the day little tiny Kirby cucumbers. They fill you up, they're filled with water, and they're basically caloric. Is this a good idea?
Well, I think you may need some other supplements and nutrients to make your day complete, but that pickle diet sounds pretty good.
All right. We are now going to, let's see here. Yeah, Alice has been hanging around. Okay, Alice, your turn. Sorry for making you wait. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had almost 2 years ago a colon cancerous tumor. And before I knew it, it was great to have lost my appetite or to eat very little and have enough. The day it was removed, I was hungry. I've been trying to keep the 50 pounds that I lost off without full success. I have gained back about 15 pounds. And struggling to keep that, and I had been thinking about a sleeve. I was wondering if that's a good idea. And if I had read some things on the internet about the diet afterwards, and it sounds like quite a while you're just on liquid, like liquid protein. I don't know if that was good information or not, how long it was, and the diet afterwards.
Yeah, so the diet
and how oils affect healthy oils.
Yep. Sorry about that. The diet after gastric sleeve is fairly prescribed in the first couple of weeks to make sure that patients can stay hydrated and not have nausea, vomiting, end up having that sleeve come apart or end up back in the hospital or with complications. Eventually, long-term patients can eat regular food, but in smaller quantities, and that's the whole purpose of how the sleeve works. So there is a prescribed diet, and as you go through a program, the dietitians will work with you fairly regularly and religiously on how you need to stay on the diet for it. So the combination of the lower calorie restriction and then the surgery does result in some weight loss, but long-term, to keep your weight off, you have to do the same things always, is diet, exercise, and lifestyle. So as you're finding right now, as my diet improves and I have more hunger, I need to sort of balance that with other exercise or activity changes to keep my weight down. So if you do want to look at that, you know, there are ways to look from a nutritional standpoint, and people can give you counseling about what your caloric needs should be and what proteins and what things would satisfy your caloric intake in a day. And those are things that can help you maintain your weight now rather than jumping towards an operation. And if you are thinking about an operation, if you do have had colon cancer, you have some special criteria that need to be looked at, some other testing that would need to be done before you would jump ahead to be able to do that. So best to get involved early so that you can get all the resources you need to help yourself long term.
Mm-hmm. Well, several years ago, I was on a low-carb diet and seems to be the only diet that I can maintain. I have a very high sensitivity to carbs, which is in so many things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if that's also an okay thing.
To be on a low-carb diet.
To keep my weight, to try to maintain now, I pretty much have to stay away from carbs that I'm very attracted to.
Okay. Doctor?
So there's been big arguments back and forth about low-fat, low-carb,
yeah,
high-fat, high-anything. It's really a balance of all of the above. You know, I tell patients I'd love to write a book, but I really can't because a couple equations sort of determine how and what will happen for your weight. One is if you take more calories in than you expend, you'll gain weight. And two, if you take in less calories than you need, you'll lose weight. And so that's really what the balance is. And a lot of times carbohydrates make us feel hungry very quickly afterwards because of the insulin release that comes from it. So a low-carb diet limits some of that sort of increasing hunger, snacking in between with it. So if you do have other health problems and other medical problems, it's best to get advice either from your primary or from a nutritional specialist to help you tailor that diet to what's going to help you with your medical issues rather than jumping and saying, well, I've got to try this diet and that diet and the other diet, because there's about 100 diets and you can wake up at 2 a.m. in the morning after you've watched Gunsmoke and see the next diet that's out there.
Well, it's probably been on all of them. I'm 71, and I've had a problem since my teenage years.
Yep, I would tell you best talk to your primary about that.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. All right, now we're going to read a letter that came in, and it goes as follows. I thought I should read it before the end of the show. Let's see. Good afternoon, doctors. My husband is 61 and has, in my words, an irrational fear of doctors. He developed a hernia 30 years ago and has never seen a doctor for anything. He is quite slim, and the hernia looks like he has a towel stuffed in his pants. Is it too late for surgery? Whenever I mention seeing a doctor, he literally goes pale. Help. Linda.
So I would tell you, Linda, that it's not past the point of getting it repaired. Repairing it may take a little extra time, it may take a little extra work in rebuilding his abdominal wall and doing that, but I think it is something that potentially could be more beneficial for him. So I would tell him, you know, don't be afraid of the doctor, be afraid of the potential problems that may occur if your hernia becomes a bigger issue. So it would be something that we'd consider to do, and, you know, it is something that he should consider getting done, because only as he gets older, more and more will herniate through and become bigger and bigger as time passes.
He needs some counseling too, right? I mean, that probably. In order to get there. Okay. All right. So we're going to go now to Jessica in Half Moon. Jessica in Half Moon, you're on.
Hi. I was calling because I got the gastric sleeve 5 days ago, so I'm 5 days post-op. And I was just wondering, because I'm part of many Facebook groups, there's a lot of support out there, like, all over our country, which is amazing. But it's very concerning, like, how the diets are so drastically different, like, post-op. Like, for example, because I'm in this area where I got it done, I'm on a 7-day liquid diet, and then, you know, for 4 weeks I do purees. And then you talk to other people, and they're on a 2-week liquid diet, and then they just move to soft foods. So I was just kind of wondering with, you know, something like the sleeve, it's obviously done the same way. Why is the after-surgery eating different for different people?
So it's a good question. The principles are usually always the same, which is that you need to eat some type of mechanically altered diet. And so you need to be basically on liquids till the swelling around the time of surgery is decreased and that you're able to then tolerate something. And that's sort of a variable that occurs from patient to patient. So some people have more swelling, less swelling after surgery. Some people tolerate things much earlier than others. So trying to get an average diet is a challenge for most programs. And programs have sort of ideas about how they do the operation. So how you do the operation then affects how quickly things would sort of become less swollen, how quickly you can advance your diet. But in general, you know, I can talk specifically about our program. We want patients to maintain their hydration, maintain their ability to stay out of the hospital, supplement themselves now with protein drinks, which allow patients to be able to stay on a liquid diet much longer and also maintain weight reduction. 10, 15 years ago, there weren't as many options for nutritional supplementation, nutritional care, and patients would end up coming back in the hospital and then being rehospitalized for 2-3 days because there weren't as many choices. So as we've had that, there's lots of different variations. So as they say, there's multiple ways to skin a cat. It just is matters that you do stay on the protocol that your program has told you. And before the surgery, I'm sure they've outlined with you how and what they want you to do, because if you follow that pathway, less likely to develop problems, less likely to have complications.
Yeah. Now, I guess my only other question is, we're talking to people even through my program, when it gets to the puree stage versus the soft foods, I know a lot of people say, well, I don't really do purees because I'll just do the soft foods and I'll chew really well to swallow. Now, is that something okay to do? Because it seems like a lot of people do it. Like, what is the purpose of pureeing it to the baby food consistency? Is that still for healing?
We're gonna get an answer for you, Jessica. Go ahead, Doc.
The answer is that if you don't chew your food very well, and people chew their food to different degrees and eat at different times and patterns, you get food that goes through at different sizes. When you puree it, it tends to be a fairly similar consistency like a liquid to go through. So the problem occurs if you don't chew well and that piece of food gets stuck in your sleeve and you retch and vomit and tear the sleeve open and then have a leak or problem, that's a significant complication. So to err on the side of safety, if you follow the sort of pathway that your program says, that you end up then not having that occur. So safety is always our biggest key. And so when people prescribe something for you, it's trying to be the safest way possible.
Okay, thank you. 65 years ago, Paul, I had my tonsils taken out along with my twin brother, and we were given ice cream afterwards. I take it ice cream is a no-no on post-op here.
It's not the most perfect thing to take after weight loss surgery. It is a liquid and can melt and help you, but the caloric intake sort of defeats some of the purpose. That's why we're talking about nutritional shakes and protein shakes, which are now much better for it. But for tonsils, that's a great thing.
Yeah. Okay. Hi, says Shauna. I had an umbilical hernia repair about a year and a half ago. Surgeon believed the hernia may have been from giving birth. She inserted a mesh, all was good at post-op appointment. My question is if I am more or less at risk for hernias. Are certain people more susceptible? My father had multiple has had multiple. I'm 36. I am not overweight, but would like to begin exercise. But I wonder if I should be wary of stressing my abdomen. I feel conscious of my abdomen when I lift things. Thank you.
So it's a fairly common question, and people who have a lot of family members who've had hernias are in that category of people who will develop hernias after having either operation or other events. So we don't understand exactly how the collagen deposition pathways occur, but we do know that there is not a true genetic link, but there is a true familial link. Patients are more likely to develop hernias. So if you look around and other people in your family have had hernias, unfortunately you need to blame your parents and then blame their parents and go backwards.
Why not? We always do.
Yeah. So that's really the cause, is that it's because it's more familial from that aspect of it. So can you start activity? Yes, you can. Should you notice a bulge or pain or difficulty, probably should get looked at either by your GYN or your primary to ascertain whether you've developed one or not. And then they could prescribe for you what the best alternatives would be at that point.
So nobody is on the phone right now, so I was going to ask you a question. We've discussed it many times. For those people who have esophageal problems and have little Barrett's or need some kind of a repair on a hiatal hernia, you do those. You repair them.
Yep.
And yet many gastroenterologists don't like the idea at all and advise against it. What's the deal there?
So hiatal hernias and reflux is a surgical procedure that sort of goes back 40-plus years. And a lot of times what we think about the procedure when we trained and we learned about it is different than what we talk about today. So these days, there's multiple different ways to fix a hiatal hernia and do things to help you not have reflux. And the outcomes from these are actually become quite good, where we talk about chances of failure in the order of single digits, 2% potentially for that. So new implantable device like a Lynx, like a bead chain that goes across the esophagus, can now work for people who don't want to have a surgical procedure like a fundoplication to improve the outcomes from it. But it is still thought by gastroenterologists, other medical providers, that these are not, they're big operations, there's a lot of disability, dysfunction, which leads to then not being suggested. And there's lots of myths like on Facebook and other places as well about outcomes that have occurred from it. So the reality and the fiction are sort of not merged well. The fiction overcomes the reality a lot of times for this. But if you talk to patients who've had operations for reflux and you talk about quality of life, they always have a universal statement, which they say, I wish I would have done this 10 years ago. So that's the reality to me about some of this, is that that's an operation that tends to be very helpful for them.
And arguing the other side of this, the downside of not doing it, right, is that you're taking certain medications to keep your stomach fluids non-acidic. And in some cases, some of the things that have been suggested about that, correct me if I'm wrong, and I often am, is that you can be get into trouble. We think that osteoporosis may result as a result of taking lifelong medications, which were originally designed, you know, for a couple of months.
Now, your reading of the medical literature is absolutely perfect there, Alan, and the fact that these medications were originally approved for 6 months, years at a time, a year at most at the time when they first improved. But now 10, 15 years into it, we see osteoporosis, potentially dementia, potentially mineral disorders that are all occurring from it. And the question is do I continue with that risk long term, or do I continue with an operation that potentially solves all these things and sort of resets the system for me? And that's the debate where we talk about, how do I want to be proactive for my quality of health, quality of life, or do I want to be reactive and wait till I have a problem? I think we're sort of seeing a generational shift in people trying to be proactive to improve their quality of life rather than reactive. And I think that's a question you always want to ask your physician or ask yourself, where do I fit on that spectrum?
And how long does it take to recover from that? In other words, you just mentioned that there's sometimes complications. How long does it take?
So we actually did a couple of those operations today before we came to talk to you. 90% of those patients will go home the next day. Within about a week, they'll be back to sort of light duty. Within about 2 weeks, they'll be back to a desk job. And within 4 weeks, they'll be back to sort of normal activity without any limitations. Now, a lot of these people will not have reflux starting tomorrow, so they won't have any reflux, need any medications, or need anything from that point going forward. And their dietary changes take about 2-3 weeks for swelling to go away and then go back to sort of normal dietary habits. So within first 4 weeks, you change your life for the potential next 10, 20, 30-plus years of your life.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll go to Nancy very quickly. Nancy, it's got to be a one-sentence question and a one-sentence answer. Go ahead, Paul.
Hello. I just wanted to know about the gastric surgery that's done through the throat. It's a type of gastric sleeve, I believe it is. And is it obscene at all?
Yep.
You know of that. Thank you.
Okay, great.
So the endoscopic gastric sleeve is a new procedure being done, still experimental for a lot of places, not being performed, I think, here in upstate yet because not covered by insurance and not still out of the experimental phase.
Okay, we're out of time. Thank you, everybody. Fran, we're sorry we're not going to get to you today. Thanks to our friend, Dr. Paul Singh of Albany Medical Center, for joining us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from Villa Veritas Foundation, Cohasset, New York, helping fight the epidemic opiate crisis both locally and throughout the country with specialized programs, education, and support for men, women, and families. VillaVeritas.org for inquiries. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy, Joe Mackowitz for answering the phone, producer Jim LaVoo. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.